Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working at...
An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Hello, everyone, in 0 degree Denver. This is Chuck Bonner, Julie Hayden, the Chuck and Julie Grassroots Show, True Straight Up.
Brought to you by Mountain West Wellness, Advanced Acupuncture, and Chinese Medicine. I'm coming up momentarily. Coming up right now, we're going to talk about Trump winning, more winning stuff going on today. And the latest left-wing crazed phrase. But right now we wanted to start off with Dr. John West. He's with the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, author of numerous books, including his latest, The Stockholm Syndrome Christianity, Why Christian Leaders Are Failing and What We Can Do About It. Dr. West, hey, thank you for your time. Appreciate it today.
Hi, Julie and Chuck. Thanks for having me on.
You bet.
So let me basically start out by, from what I gather, what you're saying is Christian leaders are essentially being sort of held cultural captive by the anti-Christians and they're falling for it. Why don't you explain what you mean by Stockholm Syndrome Christianity?
Yeah, the thesis of my book is, we like often as Christians to blame atheists and secularists for all our problems, and they certainly have made things worse. But I increasingly recognize that, in fact, a lot of Christian leaders and Christian institutions are basically enabling that. And they're basically buying into cultural captivity. So Stockholm Syndrome is this idea that you end up adapting to the views of your abuser or your hostage taker. There was actually a bank robbery in the 1970s that's named after it. But the basic idea is that if you spend your life surrounded by anti-Christian elites, then you end up adopting some of their worldview more than, and you actually look to that as your peer group and then to your fellow Christians or to solid Christian teaching. So you're basically carrying water for the secular elite, and trying to get your fellow Christians to believe that rather than witnessing to the secular elite saying, well, no, you're going the wrong way.
Didn't we see that play out? I mean, I would say a perfect example of that is all the churches, right, that canceled services during COVID. Would that be a good example?
I think that's a hard example, although I do talk about it in my book, because certainly in the early months, people wanted to do the right thing and they wanted to not infect their neighbors and things. But I think certainly as it dragged on and it became clear that the governments were applying double standards. So like in Nevada, you can have lots of people go and gamble, but you just couldn't go to church. Yeah. Then I think the churches that were still paying attention to that, that is an example. Go ahead.
Give us a couple examples of what you mean.
Yeah, so for 12 years, I was a Christian college professor, and I saw sort of how this happened in real time, adrift at the university I was at. And just 2 or 3 years ago, the university where I had been at was in the national news media because over 70% of its faculty voted basically in rejection of biblical marriage between a man and a woman. And so, when you have a Christian university, it still calls itself a Christian university, where 70% of the faculty reject biblical marriage, I think, that is an example that they are really imbibing and adopting the views of the secular elite, and rather than biblical teaching. And there's just so many cases. So, you mentioned COVID. Well, one of the most, controversial, powerful scientists in America at the time was Francis Collins. Well, Francis Collins is a personally devout Christian, yet while he was the head of NIH, he spent millions of our tax dollars to set up tissue banks to harvest aborted baby parts from babies as old as 42 weeks in gestation to harvest them to use for research. And he proclaimed himself as a devout evangelical Christian. Well, but he was also responsible for authorizing money going to the harvesting of aborted baby parts for research, including some really gruesome experiments where they took scalps from babies and put them into mice to create humanized rodents for research. I mean, just really awful. But this was done by a Christian.
Yeah. Well, let's not even talk about Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden, huh? I mean, because they're just kind
or, of... Or quite frankly,
oh, yeah.
You know, they're both Catholics, but the Pope.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Pope is the most secularized person on the planet.
I mean, those are very good examples. And then, you know, if you look at the more I look, one reason I wrote this is that the more I look, I saw all of these cases where cultural catastrophe was happening. That if you actually look closely, some of the key enablers were self-identified Christians. It wasn't just the atheists. I'll give you one more example. Most people will know that our U.S. Supreme Court invented a right to gay marriage in 2015. That was not in the Constitution. It still isn't. But the court basically invented a right. But the key vote in that case, the person who wrote the opinion, was not an atheist, was not an agnostic, was a committed Catholic Christian who was known as a goody-goody. He attended Mass every week. Anthony Kennedy, appointed by Ronald Reagan. So the deciding vote that invented a right of gay marriage that didn't exist was not a plot by an atheist or even a self-described liberal, let alone a Democrat. It was a church-going Catholic Christian appointed by Ronald Reagan. That's an example of Stockholm Syndrome Christianity.
How did it get to this? I mean, I could see where, I mean, frankly, I could kind of see if you're Nancy Pelosi, you know, she's probably not what someone would ever hold up to be like a major religious leader. But like you've said, sure. There are other people who maybe you would consider somebody who would be standing up. How did it get to the point where this is going on, like you said, where the Christians essentially have given in to the cultural captors?
Great question. So my book is actually in three sections. One is symptoms, the last one is cures, but the middle is causes. And because I think in order to understand how we get out of this, which is really the goal of my book, I think we do have to understand the causes. And so I think one big one is, who do we listen to? And it turns out that, at least in my experience, a lot of my Christian friends, or when I see their children sort of going away in this direction, and I look at, well, where are they getting their information about the world? Well, it's not from your show. It may be from CNN. It may be from the New York Times. It may be from Google. It may be from certain social media things that really are, or Wikipedia, that are notoriously slanted. And so in that chapter, I go through like seven key sources that even many Christians get their information from, and just show how manipulating they are. Even something as simple as, you know, people do a Google search to find something. Well, you know, if you do a Google search for pro-life information or information on abortion, or even Christ, try using the term crisis pregnancy center, I will virtually guarantee you the first thing, one of the first hits that come up, it says it's Pregnancy Center Finder, that actually is a fake website that if you go to is an attack on pro-life centers as fake women's health centers. And so this is, but that's what are in the search results. So again, if you look to the, if you're imbibing all the time bad information sources, that is going to impact your views of the world, no matter what you think. So that's one thing. So we look for bad, listen to the wrong people. The second one is, I saw this among my college faculty, is, but I think it's true everywhere in politics, we try to please the wrong people. In other words, so it's not just that we're listening to bad sources, but the people that we're really trying to please and get into good favor with are some of the worst cultural actors. And this is certainly true with Francis Collins. I mean, near the end of his tenure at NIH, he was praised by left-wing secular magazines for, oh, we were afraid when he was a Christian. They pretty much said this in the articles, that might somehow, you know, impact his views. But we learned that they didn't. He basically did everything we wanted. And so they praised him. And he was referring favorites from the wrong people. So I think that's another thing. And then the final really big issue as to why this comes about, and this reflects on our institutions. Why do churches go astray? Why do Christian universities go off the deep end? Why do Christian schools? It really is a failure of leadership to hold people accountable. In my university, the reason why 70% of the faculty ended up rejecting biblical marriage, who do I blame? I don't actually blame the liberal faculty. They were doing what they think is right, even though it was wrong. But I saw decisions made by our board of trustees that were, these were personally orthodox theologically conservative, often taught in major parachurch Bible study groups. They were our board members, and they did not have the courage of their convictions. They enabled it. They basically handed over the university to the theologically unorthodox faculty and didn't do anything, even if it was brought to their attention. And they knew, and the thing is, they knew better, but they enabled it. And so I think that in many institutions, if you have things just outright heresy and other stuff breaking up out, you go back to the people who are the elders or the boards or the people who are appointed, you know, to be responsible. You often find personally orthodox people who are not willing to, they don't have the courage of their conviction. They don't have backbone.
But what about
a lot of the at least Protestant sects these days, they're dividing up into what you call secular and the more believing portions. I mean, the Methodists are the most recent example.
That's right.
And I was trying to look for a Methodist church in our area and so forth. And, you know, it was kind of amazing. I think the left wing is called Universalist Methodist. But maybe that's a good sign. Maybe those who are true believers need to get away from those who purport to be Christians when really they just despise the opinions of normal Christians.
Yeah, I think it's a prudential choice that if an institution, you know, you shouldn't leave willy-nilly or give up institutions willy-nilly. On the other hand, if it's gone beyond reasonably the point of no return, then you probably are well advised to separate and start new institutions. And Christians did that, say, in the late 19th century, after many people don't know that Harvard, Princeton, Yale, all of those were originally started as explicitly Christian institutions. But by the 1800s, they weren't anymore. They were lost, largely because, again, board members and others who weren't willing to uphold the missions. And so they started a whole new range of colleges. The Seattle Pacific University, where I taught, was started by the Free Methodists in the 1890s. And, you know, as part of that movement for more, solid Christian institutions. But one of the hardest things to do, Abraham Lincoln said in one of his addresses, is not just founding an institution, but perpetuating it to the next generation. And so I think this is where we really do have something that we need to teach people. We need to teach people who are going to be in leadership. We need to teach people who are in the pews. Well, your role, the role of all of us, to sort of hold each other accountable and to, you know, not in a harsh or mean or, you know, way, but in a loving way, but we should still have backbones of holding things and protecting the truth and protecting the missions of our institutions.
What role does money play in this? As we're watching, and I'm talking about too with NGOs, a lot of the NGOs, you know, you've got Catholic Charities, you've got the Lutheran-based, whatever it is, right, that have gotten involved. Yeah, involved in the immigration thing. And now we're learning through DOGE that the hundreds of millions of dollars that have been sort of fraudulently poured into these organizations, does that play a role too? I mean, if I'm Catholic Charities, you know, and I'm making bazillions of dollars, which I'm sure filters around to other so-called Catholic organizations. I mean, this is a money train or a gravy train, right?
Yeah.
And you don't want to like raise your hand and say, wait a minute, what would God think about all of this? Because then your money gets cut off.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think money can help unlevel the playing field and giving bad people a comparative advantage. You know, if you have a biblical charity and you're, you know, doing it, but you're just relying on voluntary contributions, and then you have a heterodox Christian charity in name only that gets massive government funding, then that is a disadvantage. What I will say, though, is I don't think, in my experience, with involved with Christian leaders and institutions, the money, it can be corrupting, but if they start taking it, it's because they've already been corrupted. In other words, they want the money because they want to push those things.
That makes
so
sense.
It can give them a comparative, you know, it does harm things because it gives even more power that they wouldn't ordinarily have. Say, a Christian institution that gets a lot of bad money, it insulates them from the healthy pressures of ordinary donors who may be biblically orthodox. Having said that, you know, Jesus says we talk out of the things that are in our heart. And when people are starting to take that money is off is because they've already made those compromises.
So how do we fix it? How do we get, I mean, that's the other part of your book, right? The cure.
Yeah. So I think, you know, just following off of what I've already said about that. So for information sources, we have are awash with good information sources if you want to find them. And so I think training our, you know, with parents, with kids, people in our church, people, our friends, is going to solid information sources that are not biased against Christians or that are not trying to skew things in various ways against, you know, traditional Christian beliefs. So I think paying attention to who we're getting information from and getting good information. I think learning that we shouldn't be trying to seek to please the wrong people. And then if you're a church elder or a deacon or a board member of a Christian school or you're friends with someone who is, training those people about their number one priority is not the finances of the institution, it's to defend the mission of their institution. Now, those are sort of some big things, but I, in my book, have about 21 things that whether you're a parent, a grandparent, a pastor, or a teacher, you can do. And let me just give one of those. It's very specific, and it may seem like, oh, that's, I mean, who wouldn't do that? But it's really actually important. It's under the banner of do no harm. That goes back actually to the ancient Greeks. There were doctors who said the number one thing a doctor should do before they even try to kill you, don't do any harm. So how do these, you know, Stockholm syndrome, Christian institutions and things flourish? Well, one reason is you have people who are complicit, who themselves are not Stockholm syndrome Christians and do know better, but they're not willing to walk the walk. Or so, for example, they give money to their college or university because they have warm, fuzzy feelings from 30 years ago when they were a student there, when maybe it was solid, and they're just giving it out of, you know, long-term emotional feelings when they're actually bankrolling a institution that now is not godly. And I know some large-scale Christian donors who have given to institutions that they knew really weren't great, but they have these warm feelings from the past. And I have to say that people like that in some ways are even worse than the atheist or the materialist or the progressive Christian, so-called, because if you know better, you should enable it. Similarly, in a church, if you have a church, and I don't think people should leave churches willy-nilly. The last church that my wife and I were in before our current one, we were in 18 years, and we only left after some really serious changes that really forced us to, you know, feel that we couldn't really support it. But I know a church in my area that was traditionally fairly solid, but then their pastor came out explicitly endorsing gay marriage. Well, if you're biblically faithful in that, you should have left that congregation. But I know a lot of people who, well, because of, we're friends with these people and my wife is friends with them, my husband is friends with them, so they stayed and continued to donate. Well, you are enabling that then. You're now not just that, you're part of the problem. So do no harm. So even if you're not going to give the good things, I think Christians should, we're obliged to, but even if you're not going to do that, adopt the principle, do no harm. Who are you complicit with? What organizations are you actually helping to move forward? Because I will tell you, if Christians in a concerted effort paid attention to that, a lot of this stuff would change, because this is the other side of the financing. People may take bad financing because they've already made changes. But if you withdraw the funding, then they will either go out of existence or they will reform.
Or they will get, yeah, they'll get differently. Well, just a couple more questions. It seems to me too that some of it comes and Christian, I mean, I think religion has sort of adapted this, that this attitude that everything is relative, right? It's a very progressive Democrat attitude. It's your truth. It's my truth. There is no like the truth. And so basically, I think it creates a pretty hedonistic kind of society where you can really find a justification for doing whatever it is you want. And there is no absolute right and wrong anymore. I mean, does that kind of attitude play in at all, do you think?
To the hardcore Stockholm Syndrome Christians, they are influenced by that attitude. Now, most of them probably would say, well, no, you know, they believe certain things are right, although sometimes they'll say, well, I personally believe, but then we can't do anything. I think the way that view that you just said really burrows into Christians is they have a false view of winsomeness and love. Now, I think Christians should not be unduly harsh. I think we do need to be loving, but a biblical standard of love is different than the world's. The world's love is, well, you know, make someone feel, you know, you never want to make someone feel bad. That's not the biblical view. If someone's going to hell or if someone's destroying their life through drug addiction or, you know, say they have a series of, you know, they're being they're unfaithful to their spouse with a series of adulterous relationships and they're harming their kids, that is not loving to say, oh, yeah, I understand that, you know, that's hard, that's good, you know, I support you. And that you're actually supporting them over the cliff. So yeah. I think one of it is in a lot of the Christian community, we have people who think that they're being loving. Oh, let me give you another example from my old university, and this is from after I left there. So the university, I think one reason why you had 70% of the faculty reject biblical marriage is because, and they end up having an authorized gay group and everything. This is a Christian institution, is that they probably thought, well, they were being loving to the people who, you know, disagreed on these matters. But what they didn't realize was how cruel they were being to the faithful students who are now being bullied. And there was a group of faithful biblical, faithful students at Seattle Pacific who sent to the Board of Trustees saying, look, now we're not even allowed to give the biblical view on marriage or sex in class without being bullied and being belittled by the faculty or fellow students. And the faculty actually give lots of time for the gay lobby in the classes to belittle us, but when we're not even allowed to say that. So what the Christians who enable this, especially in the institution, they think they're being loving to people who hate Christ, but in fact, they're being very cruel to the most vulnerable among us, you know, young people, other people who are trying to be biblically faithful. And so I do think that a lot of this is this very false, pernicious, almost demonic view of love that is not correct. There is, we are called to be loving, but it's not the same as the world's love.
Let me, so doctor, we have to let you go. We've been talking with Dr. John West about his new book. I'm assuming your book is everywhere, right? Where can people get it and find out more about you?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble. If you want to find more about it, go to the book's website where I have a lot of free resources too, even if you don't want to buy the book, but of course, hope people will buy the book.
Yeah, buy the book.
StockholmSyndromeChristian.com. So StockholmSyndromeChristian.com.
All right.
Thank you. Okay. Have a good day.
Thank you, sir. Dr. John West there, Stockholm Syndrome. And I think, it's very interesting. I think, and his point is we need to start, you know, at all levels to take things back. Want to kind of switch gears here a little bit, Chuck. I think this is pretty funny. The Democrats, I think, we've talked about this, you and I have. It's like they're taking the lane, and I think you came up with this. It's like, make America corrupt again, right? Mm-hmm. Trump is trying to clean things out, and basically that's all they talk about. It's, no, we need to make America corrupt again. We can't clean this whole thing up. And the latest phrase they've come to, and you got to love how the Democrats do this, is constitutional crisis, right? I was reading an interesting thing, and it talked about how the left ends up pushing this narrative. And what you do is you have people who are in managerial or assignment kind of levels of various, and it's only some of the key organizations, right? Like New York Times, maybe CNN, Washington Post, and Associated Press, right? And what happens is they get a call, or maybe they call their source at the White House, well, previously at the White House or the Democrat Party now, and say, hey, what's going on today? And they say, oh, guess what? We have a constitutional crisis. And they go, ooh. So they go back to the reporter and say, hey, we need to start working on stories about constitutional crisis. And then CNN goes, oh my God, AP says we have a constitutional crisis. Let's book some guests who can talk about constitutional crisis. And then it filters down all over the world, except for the Glendale Cherry Creek Chronicle, but into local media too. And all of a sudden you got Kyle Clark talking about constitutional crisis. And this occurred, and this video, I mean, Jesse Waters had it. This is hysterical. This occurred most recently because they've tried all kinds of things, but this, over just a course of a couple of days, this is what we have now. So, Doug, if we could please play the constitutional crisis. This is a compilation.
Constitutional crisis is the phrase of the week.
We are 3 weeks into the second Trump presidency, 3 weeks, and tonight, there are warnings that the U.S. is dangerously close to a constitutional crisis.
That is a constitutional crisis. That is a crisis for our democracy.
We've got our toes right on the edge of a constitutional crisis here.
What we are witnessing is a constitutional crisis.
To defy court orders brings about a constitutional crisis.
We've moved from a constitutional crisis to a constitutional collapse.
Constitutional crisis is not a new talking point.
So there you go, Chuck. We have a constitutional crisis. It's funny how they all do that. And of course, what is this constitutional crisis based on? The fact that Trump is exercising his constitutional authority, right?
Well, no, I actually agree there is a potential constitutional crisis. The powers of the 200...
But it's not Trump.
Well, no, it is caused by the actions of Trump, in which you have 200 federal district court judges who really, if they want to, can rule anything they want to, and they do, and often they often give injunctions for the entire country, which would appear to be utterly illegal. I mean, you can do it for the area you're in, but since when do district court judges have nationwide powers? And there hasn't been a pushback against the seizing of so much power by district courts. I mean, they really have gone way overboard. There's nothing to say that any one of 200 federal district court judges at any time can decide that it will contradict the president and do whatever they want to. And I think there is the one where, you know, we have to have something where there isn't. Because, you know, say, well, you can win on appeal. Well, appeals, unless it's an emergency one, take a year, more than a year. I mean,
I think Trump should just ignore it. And I would argue, and you're the lawyer.
Ignore it, but then you're going to have a constitutional crisis.
Well, not really, because here's what I would say. I don't think the Constitution gives a separation of powers, right? But the Constitution the Constitution deals with the Supreme Court, right? The Constitution, nowhere in the Constitution does it talk about hundreds of little, you know, district court judges. So I think I would argue, and you're the lawyer, but constitutionally, it means that Trump has to kind of listen to what the Supreme Court says, which, of course, Joe Biden didn't do with the student loan aid. But nowhere in the Constitution does it say that Trump, that the executive commander, the executive branch of the United States has to listen to some obscure district court in some blue state. So, I mean, I would say that's not a constitutional crisis. They're trying to make it one.
Well, it is a constitutional crisis, and it's been going on for a long time, quite frankly. Of how much power do the courts have? And that goes back to the early 1800s. But the idea that a local district court judge can make incredibly broad-based rulings has not been fought back enough. I mean, it really should be that they have no authority. Maybe you say it has to be heard by the Supreme Court, or it has to be heard by at least an appellate court. But the system is breaking down.
Yes.
They're just,
I wouldn't call that a crisis. I would call that just in time. I mean, I know that that's because Trump is in charge now. But I mean, the way I look, this is I think maybe ignored is a wrong word. And right now, Trump has kind of said, okay, I'll kind of abide to it. But I think in the meantime, though, he's got so many other things he's doing that they can't keep track. But for instance, when they say, you know, Trump doesn't have the authority to do something to fire somebody, right? That he clearly has the authority to fire, or that the court said he has to put the LGBTQ websites back up by Friday. If I'm Trump, so here's how that would play out. That's to just say Trump says, no, he doesn't, right? Well, so now he's in contempt of court. Well, who's going to have to eventually prosecute the contempt of court? Well, the Justice Department, which is now run by Pam Bondi, right? So Pam Bondi could just turn around and say, I dismiss that, right? I mean, isn't that how it could play out?
Well, they could. The judge could send out U.S. Marshals to enforce it.
Right, but Trump's now in charge of the U.S. Marshals. Christine Noem could say U.S. Marshals are not going to go do that.
Well,
right.
They may. You might get some rogue U.S. Marshals.
Then you'd fire them. Do you see what I'm saying, though? I mean,
I'm telling you, there is a constitutional crisis, and it's the assumption of power, and you know,
I wouldn't say assumption.
It's happening worldwide. In Brazil, you have a Supreme Court justice who's really running the country. He's decided he'll run it. In Israel, the Israeli Supreme Court decided that it could contradict any opinion of the prime minister if it was unreasonable. And you had somewhat of the same thing in Poland. So it really is a worldwide one where courts have said, hey, wait a minute, screw the elected officials. We can do it on our own. And
I
I think
think
it's here it is where we should not allow these district courts' opinions to not only stand but be allowed to have any validity to them. I mean, we have to control the district courts across the country, and it really needs to be done, and nobody's really sure how to do it. There's some idea that you'd have a panel of appellate court judges do it or something else, but everybody realizes that the checks and balances are getting skewed.
Well, and I think that's helpful because I think, well, helpful in terms of, I mean, we already saw how people, they saw how that lawfare weaponized the criminal justice system against Trump, right? And then people didn't care. And I think the Democrats are going, and the courts once again are going too far. When they, anything and everything that Trump does, when they're saying some obscure judge somewhere is saying he can't do it, I think that that sets the stage for, say, for instance, if Trump doesn't put the LGBTQ website back up on Friday, the Democrats are going to scream. And once again, no one's going to care. It's like, you know, they're going to be like, whatever. Right. And I think that if you're Trump, you could say, make me. I mean, you know, so I think, I don't know. I think it's them. And maybe I guess you could call that a crisis, but it's just, and it was, oh, is that Charlene? Is that,
yeah.
Somebody, go ahead.
Can I speak to that?
Sure.
It's looking like the, Trump administration is employing the six ways from Sunday tactics to bring about leverage against some of these bad actors. They just tweeted out that Bondi has announced the DOJ is taking legal action against the state of New York, the governor, Kathy Hochul, Letitia James, and Mark Schroeder for prioritizing illegal aliens over Americans. And, you know, it's like they can come, they can go at after them in many different ways, because aren't a lot of these judges doing this in New York?
Yes. New York and Washington, D.C.
They've got ways to go after them that they're like, cry uncle, you know, like, okay, right. We get it.
Well, the problem is she's got to go to a district court to do that. She can't do it on her own. She may be bringing legal actions, but they're legal actions in federal district courts. And so if you get a liberal federal judge, you'll just go, no.
But you know, it's interesting to Charlene's point, and I read something about this, and they said that it's not an accident that Elon Musk is suddenly talking about how are all these people in government who aren't really making very much money, how come all of a sudden they're worth tens of millions of dollars, or we're going to follow that? And I think, yeah. I mean, that's a threat, right? I mean, if you're the judge, if
pressure on them in different ways to where it's just too much to resist, you know, like the firing of these four FEMA people,
right.
You know, Benny Johnson, if you listen to him, he's calling for them to be prosecuted, because what they did is they defied an executive order, and they even put up on their website that said we're something like, this is what you do to go around this executive order because it has been challenged by, you know, a judge. So therefore, it's temporary. There has been a restraint put on it. So they knowingly circumvented the executive order, hoping this judge would be their recourse, you know, the judge's
right.
action. So, but they found out that wouldn't help them. So those people are now fired, but there's been no action taken against them to prosecute them, because, you know, like Benny says, the only way to stop this is, you know, the path of least resistance. If that's all they're going to get is fired, then the
right.
other ones in other departments are going to say, well, you know, if we get fired, so be it. But this is our activist duty.
Right.
You know, this is
our
sort
of like, like the FBI agents who are leaking the information about the ICE raids, right? Rahman is
exactly.
like, no, I want them
if they
to go
just
to
get
jail.
Fired, to slap on the hand, they're like, okay, well, one down, we got 500 more. And so, you know, I'm just hoping AG Bondi exercises a lot of her power. And, you know, we've got a lot of leverage against these bad actors. And it seems like this is the last leg they have to stand on, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
No.
Yeah, they don't have any other options.
She has no power in and of herself. She only has the power to go to a district court and have the court do theirs. I mean, all of it is dependent upon courts doing what Bondi or someone else wants.
But you don't think Bondi can find one court to do that?
Well,
yeah. She's got the whole country to choose from,
just
like they do now.
Jurisdiction, whether it'll take it. If it's a person in New York, then only, you know.
Maybe she can go to Texas,
the
though.
The key thing about why they were able to torture all the January 6th defendants was that all the district courts in D.C. Circuit are liberal. And even if they're appointed by a conservative president, they've turned liberal. So no matter whose court you went into, if you're January 6th, you know, they denied you any defenses. They brought, you know, allowed ridiculous charges to be brought against you. You went to trial. They would deny you various defenses to go to the jury.
Yeah.
And the jury was rigged. No, there is a real problem right now with how the judicial system works within our, and as I said, it's not unique. It's doing in Brazil, it slightly differently, but it's happening in Israel. And I haven't heard a great solution.
You know, I just saw something from Joe Biden. He said, although the Supreme Court overruled my ability to forgive these student loans, I went ahead and forgave $5 million or $5 million worth. And so that's this thing too, you know.
I just did it. Yeah, and get the money. And like I said, what's interesting about Pam Bondi, what she can and did do was she said, okay, I clawed back the $59 million that was paid, right? And so that, it, once again, like you said, it's sort of a six ways from Sunday. They're hitting them in the pocketbook, too. It's like, okay, exactly. I'll file it in court. In the meantime.
And we owe that to Elon Musk because he's a systems genius, and he knows where all the trails go, and exactly. He can claw back money and he can put a hold on it. I mean,
exactly.
People, so it's not worth it. I'm going to go out into the private sector and get a job because, you know, no telling what's going to happen to my job. So,
That's,
all right. Thank you, Shirley.
Anybody who owns a federal job, I promise you, is not going to go.
65,000 have taken the buyout.
That's because they're all about to retire anyway.
I know, but that's still, interesting though is, Chuck, let me do this. We've got another soundbite though, but things are starting to work. And I wasn't clear, and I was trying to figure this out, whether it was the same. So a judge said that Trump can't freeze all the accounts and the grants and things that he froze, right? And I don't know if it's a different judge that ruled, no, he can, or the same judge clarified it. But at any rate, and you're not seeing this getting any play on CNN or The Hill or Politico, which is bought and paid for, by the way, by the Democrats. But apparently a judge has now said, actually Trump does have the authority to freeze money that he has authority over. If we could please, Doug, play the Trump is right soundbite.
So clarifying that the government can limit access to federal funds on the basis of the applicable authorizing statutes, regulations, and terms. Essentially, yes, the government can do so in complying with regulations. And then that the previous order does not bar both the president and much of the federal government from exercising their own lawful authorities to withhold funding without the prior approval of the district court, meaning, again, they can disperse the monies that they were allocated within the law, within the confines of the law, and that the government does not have to seek preclearance from the courts on terminating funding as long as they have the authority to do it as governed by the applicable statutory, regulatory, or grant terms. So essentially, the court is confirming what the Trump administration has maintained and what common sense can project, which is that within the confines of regulatory and normal authority, of course, you can do what you want with your own money and you don't need a court's approval to do so.
What do you think about that? I mean, that, hello, common sense, right?
And well, so I'm not sure that's true. You know, the Impoundment Act, which was really one of the key bad decisions of all time. The court back in the early 70s said that, I guess it was Nixon, he didn't get to decide how money was spent. That's the power of the purse, and therefore Congress under our Constitution has the power to designate what can be spent and what can't be spent. Well, that's resulted in all kinds of terrible things. We had Tom Tancredo on. We were talking about, they called him up after a couple of weeks on the job, and they said, we've got $76,000 left over. What do we want to do with it? And that's because of the impoundment problem. If he doesn't spend it, what happens to it? You know, Congress has said spend, so he's supposed to spend it. Of course, this means that everybody's going to spend their entire budget, and often, since there's not anything to spend the money on, maybe they'll give it to themselves.
Jesus. Although I think that this might be a little different. I think, and I could be wrong, but I think that there are some revenues that the executive branch is in charge of, and I think that's what the judge was clarifying.
It depends on the regulations and the law.
Right.
But it's a huge quagmire, quite frankly.
It is. And if you're the Supreme Court, To me, I think if you're the Supreme Court, you've got to be somewhat like going, oh my gosh. Cause I mean, every day something comes up. I mean, not every day, numerous. I mean, and you know, Hakeem Jeffries has said, we're forming a rapid response team to file lawsuits, right? So, and Trump is now responding. So if you're the Supreme Court, what do you think at what point? Because every case in its own way kind of has different nuances. But at a certain point, do you jump in now and do something? Or how, if you're the Supreme Court, I got to imagine you got to be hopefully a little concerned about this.
Well, I'm sure they are. I mean, the last time there was what I consider a big constitutional crisis was in the early 1930s, where the Supreme Court was constantly finding that the enabling legislation for the New Deal was unconstitutional. And then Roosevelt, in return for that, said, okay, great, then I'll appoint a whole more Supreme Court justices. I'll pack the court. I'll have a lot more of my own ones. But he lost the 36th election, and all of a sudden the Supreme Court started approving all the legislation. And so they said, oh, okay, well, since you're approving it all, but there is a, you know, constant tension between what the courts can do and can't do, and what's the limits of their power. But it's one thing to say whether the Supreme Court's rulings have total authority, than 200 district judges. I don't know how this is going to turn out. I really don't.
Is it a constitutional crisis being used by the left a lot? No, it's trying to set a narrative. It is. And I think that they are trying to set the narrative. But again, the problem they have with their narrative. Jacob, did you? Oh, okay. If somebody wants to.
I'm here. Yeah.
Okay,
can
go ahead.
Can I say one thing?
Sure.
The Republicans seem to be fighting back because this congressman in somewhere is filing articles of impeachment against this judge in New York.
Yep.
And these judges don't want that on their record.
Right. That's the good thing. I mean, the Democrats have gone way too far. The public sentiment is not on their side anymore. Like I said, their whole lane is make America corrupt again, or let us continue with the corruption. And that's not really a popular position. Because even today, they had at the news conference, CNN and reporters are pressing the press secretary, you know, well, how do we know there's evidence of fraud? She goes, oh, I'm glad you asked that. And she starts rattling off all of this fraud with the receipts, right? So it's there. And I think the beautiful thing about what Elon Musk is doing in his team is these algorithms, they're not just like kind of in one time and they're gone. And as soon as they leave, you know, you can go back to being corrupt. I think these things run constantly and kind of keep spitting out the information constantly. And it feeds also the narrative that people are pre-inclined to believe. Like, what did you say? They're finding people 150 years old who are getting Social Security payments, right? No. Is anyone
I heard that last night, yeah.
Yeah. And are you actually shocked to hear that? It's like, no, that's not surprising.
Well, let me go back to a couple of things you said. You know, I think it's a congressman in Texas, Goodall, bringing articles of impeachment. Well, that's not much of a threat, quite frankly, because it takes 2/3 of the Senate to convict you. And there aren't enough votes.
But he's trying, Chuck. I mean, they're pushing back. I mean,
do you think that Mayorkas cares that he was impeached? Mayorkas was impeached.
But what I'm saying, though, is, and I agree with...
And he rejected it. He didn't care.
I think they're pushing back at least. They're not just laying over and saying, oh, I guess then we can't do anything we want with the government.
Well, that's the whole point. You know, what they can do potentially is say, fine, well, I guess the budget for the judiciary is now cut in half. Is that constitutional? Who would decide that? So, you know, a lot of this is very...
But I got to wonder what else Musk is finding out. Again, you know, he's looking into Ukraine now. And I think all of a sudden you got Lindsey Graham is saying all the right things. But Murkowski is now going to support Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I mean, you got to wonder what they're finding. And I don't think it was a mistake that Elon Musk said, you know, one of the things we're looking into next is how these government people, and I'm sure he's talking about representatives to a certain extent and senators.
He's talking about Samantha Power.
Well, and other people too, but I mean,
$10 million to $30 million.
It was just one example. I mean, I think he's trying to say, if we can trace Samantha Power, guys, we can trace you too. So I think it's interesting there. And another point, though, another thing is Tulsi Gabbard was confirmed today. as Director of National Intelligence. And it looks as if Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is going to be okay, too. And I have a feeling then if those two are going to go, I mean, Kash Patel isn't really all that controversial. I mean, what do you think of that, Chuck?
Well, I think the fact that the FBI has been firing people and everything else has turned them into more. And he's their last one they can get. They'll try everything in the world to prevent Kash Patel from getting in there. And I think it's not looking good for him. But, you know, a couple of weeks can change everything.
Well, it wasn't looking that good for Tulsi Gabbard, right?
Well, Tulsi Gabbard looked awful. I mean, she looked like she definitely wasn't going to make it. Now she did, with only Mitch McConnell voting against her. Good old Mitch. And it looks like Kennedy, who is very much in trouble, he's fine. If Kash Patel gets in there, really, that's pretty much he has all of his cabinet, which is tremendous. But if left-wing groups can go to district courts anytime they want, District of Columbia in particular, and get it overturned, something's got to be done about that. But it is great that Trump has been able to get you know, a diverse cabinet, and one in which it wasn't just a lot of safe choices. In fact, they're very unsafe choices. And once they get in there, they won't just play pity pat.
I mean, well, and I think the other thing, too, is the money is on our side, right? Now it's not conservative groups or Trump having to self-fund the challenges. Right now, it's the Attorney General's office is doing it, right? So the Democrats right now are the ones who are having to come up with money to file the lawsuits and to fight the lawsuits. So,
well, they don't. They can have the states do it by having the AGs.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. Like, thank you, Jared Polis.
Yeah.
We had a ton of things. Let's see.
Just one other thing, sure, that I wanted to tell you was two of the people that are 150 years old and on Social Security. One is Mitch McConnell. The other one is the lady from San Francisco that we all love.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Dianne Feinstein.
There we go.
Yeah, I was reading a thing today. Mitch McConnell was the only Republican who voted against Tulsi Gabbard. And somebody was saying Mitch McConnell is in a wheelchair and has no idea what he's doing anymore. That was his interns voted for here. Here's from Johnny. He says the fake news says there is no fraud, specifically on CAN-US hourly news. And then Charlene says, are you serious? CAN-US is saying that? And Johnny says the national news feed they get is saying it. Yeah, I'm not sure who KNUS's news comes from anymore. But, you know, again, they can keep saying that all they want, and the Trump administration keeps coming up. I mean, you saw the thing about the reason they have a hard time, like, retiring people, it can only do somebody a month, is it's all being done by hand and stored in, like, literally some underground mine.
That's what Elon Musk
is like. And so I think, again, so CNN and MSNBC can get there and say, there's nothing there. And then they show the picture of the mine and all these papers in there. And you're going, like, you're kidding me, right? I mean, and Elon Musk is like, nope. And then they're trying to make it sound like, oh, Elon Musk and Donald Trump hate each other. And again, no one's falling for that either. So I think the Democrats, it's kind of fun to watch them twist and turn and try to come up with something. But again, the basic lane is keep the fraud going. And that's just not a particularly popular, that's not a winning message, do you think?
No, it really isn't. I mean, whether it's the paper straws or defending all the corruption in the various departments. And can you imagine how much fraud is in the Pentagon? Because they haven't gotten through an audit in 8 years. I mean, you know, if you were somebody, you know, it would be very hard to not want to steal a few million. You know, just have a you don't have to steal it directly. You just have a company who will contract with the Pentagon to do DEI or something, and charge them $10 million, and then you get it because you're a contractor to the DEI. You know, they can do it with enough chains, but.
Right.
The Pentagon's got to be even more than the Department of Education and some of the others. It's got to be because nobody, I mean, you know, all these Obama people going, we should have thought of that. Why did we think of that?
Well, and it's so kind of funny. You know, I'm sure at some point somebody was like, why didn't we think of actually letting somebody run in there and do an audit and look at things? So yeah. This is from Johnny Johnson, the sinkhole of bureaucracy. I saw that, John. That's a 2014 Washington Post story. The government had spent over $100 million since the 1980s trying to digitize retirement forms for their workers. So from 1955 to now, they're only able to process 10,000 a month. They do it by hand. Now, even I could figure out how to get someone to figure out how to digitize that, right? And then Leo, yeah, the picture of the mine, it shows Iron Mountain at the gate, which means we're paying a private company to keep the papers in a mine. It's like, yeah, it's sort of like Elon Musk is like, you can't make this stuff up, guys. And so.
No, I mean, once they really get in there, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing. And you're absolutely right that it seems like you got the Democrats going, We love corruption. We're all corrupt. Yay, corruption.
There is no fraud. Hey, listen, that's going to wrap it up for us. This went fast. Thank you to Dr. John West, everybody there on Zoom, and Doug at BBS Radio. On Friday, there's an interesting lawsuit that has come up here in Colorado that I think...
We'll know all about it, and we'll tell you all about it.
It's going to shake things up.
As the process servers are hitting the streets to serve some of your favorite people you might know.
Right. Well, but we'll tell you all about that on Friday. In the meantime, everybody have a great day, and we'll see you on Party Friday.
Bye-bye, everyone.